Ambala Lion Editions presents Memories, Dreams, Reflections by Carl Jung. Read for you by Michael York.
Prologue. My life is the story of the self-realization of the unconscious. Everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation, and the personality, too, desires to evolve out of its unconscious conditions and to experience itself as a whole. I cannot employ the language of science to trace this process of growth in myself, for I cannot experience myself as a scientific problem. Thus it is that I have now undertaken, in my 83rd year, to tell my personal myth. I can only make direct statements, only tell stories. Whether or not the stories are true is not the problem. The only question is whether what I tell is my fable, my truth. Life has always seemed to me like a plant that lives on its rhizome or root. Its true life is invisible, hidden in the rhizome. The part that appears above ground lasts only a single summer. Then it withers away, an ephemeral apparition. When we think of the unending growth and decay of life and civilizations, we cannot escape the impression of absolute nullity. Yet I have never lost a sense of something that lives and endures underneath the eternal flux. What we see is the blossom which passes. The rhizome remains. In the end, the only events in my life worth telling are those when the imperishable world erupted into this transitory one. That is why I speak chiefly of inner experiences, amongst which I include my dreams and visions. These form the prima materia of my scientific work. They were the fiery magma out of which the stone that had to be worked was crystallized. First years. When I was 6 months old, my parents moved from Kessville on Lake Constance to Laufen, the castle and vicarage above the falls of the Rhine. This was in 1875. My memories begin with my second or third year. I recall the vicarage, the garden, the laundry house, the church, the castle, the falls, the small castle of Wurt, and the sexton's farm. These are nothing but islands of memory afloat in a sea of vagueness, each by itself, apparently with no connection between them. One memory comes up, which is perhaps the earliest of my life, and is indeed only a rather hazy impression. I am lying in a pram, in the shadow of a tree. It is a fine, warm summer day, the sky blue and golden sunlight darting through the green leaves. The hood of the pram has been left up. I have just awakened to the glorious beauty of the day and have a sense of indescribable well-being. I see the sun glittering through the leaves and blossoms of the bushes. Everything is wholly wonderful, colorful, and splendid. Yet another image. I am restive, feverish, unable to sleep. My father carries me in his arms, paces up and down, singing his old student songs. To this day I can remember my father's voice singing over me in the stillness of the night. I was suffering, so my mother told me afterward, from general eczema. Dim intimations of trouble in my parents' marriage hovered around me. My illness in 1878, must have been connected with a temporary separation of my parents. My mother spent several months in a hospital in Basel, and presumably her illness had something to do with the difficulty in the marriage. An aunt of mine, who was a spinster and some 20 years older than my mother, took care of me. I was deeply troubled by my mother's being away. From then on, I always felt mistrustful when the word love was spoken. The feeling I associated with woman was for a long time that of innate unreliability. father, on the other hand, meant reliability and powerlessness. That is the handicap I started off with. Later, these early impressions were revised. I have trusted men, friends, and been disappointed by them. And I have mistrusted women, and was not disappointed. These are my outward memories. What follows now are more powerful, indeed overwhelming images, some of which I recall only dimly. At about the same time, I have the earliest dream I can remember, a dream which was to preoccupy me all my life. I was then between 3 and 4 years old. The vicarage stood quite alone near Laufen Castle, and there was a big meadow stretching back from the sexton's farm. In the dream, I was in this meadow. Suddenly I discovered a dark, rectangular, stone-lined hole in the ground. I had never seen it before. I ran forward curiously and peered down into it. Then I saw a stone stairway leading down. Hesitantly and fearfully, I descended. At the bottom was a doorway with a round arch closed off by a green curtain. It was a big, heavy curtain of material like brocade, and it looked very sumptuous. Curious to see what might be hidden behind, I pushed it aside. I saw before me in the dim light a rectangular chamber about 30 feet long. The ceiling was arched and of hewn stone. The floor was laid with flagstones, and in the center a red carpet ran from the entrance to a low platform. On this platform stood a wonderfully rich golden throne. I am not certain, but perhaps a red cushion lay on the seat. It was a magnificent throne, a real king's throne in a fairy tale. Something was standing on it, which I thought at first was a tree trunk 12 to 15 feet high and about 1.5 to 2 feet thick. It was a huge thing, reaching almost to the ceiling. But it was of a curious composition. It was made of skin and naked flesh, and on top there was something like a rounded head with no face and no hair. On the very top of the head was a single eye, gazing motionlessly upward. It was fairly light in the room, although there were no windows and no apparent source of light. Above the head, however, was an aura of brightness. The thing did not move, yet I had the feeling that it might at any moment crawl off the throne like a worm and creep toward me. I was paralyzed with terror. At that moment I heard from outside and above me my mother's voice. She called out, "Yes, just look at him. That is the man-eater." That intensified my terror still more, and I awoke, sweating and scared to death. For many nights afterward, I was afraid to go to sleep because I feared I might have another dream like that one. This dream haunted me for years. Only much later did I realize that what I had seen was a phallus. And it was decades before I understood that it was a ritual phallus. The abstract significance of the phallus is shown by the fact that it was enthroned by itself. The hole in the meadow probably represented a grave. The grave itself was an underground temple whose green curtain symbolized the meadow. In other words, the mystery of earth with her covering of green vegetation. The carpet was blood red. What about the vault? Perhaps I had been to the Mühnel, the citadel of Schaffhausen. This is not likely, since no one would take a 3-year-old child up there, so it cannot be a memory trace. Equally, I do not know where the anatomically correct phallus can have come from. The interpretation of the urethral orifice as an eye, with the source of light apparently above it, points to the etymology of the phallus, meaning shining or bright. Through this childhood dream, I was initiated into the secrets of the earth. What happened then was a kind of burial in the earth, and many years were to pass before I came out again. Today I know that it happened in order to bring the greatest possible amount of light into the darkness. It was an initiation into the realm of darkness. My intellectual life had its unconscious beginnings at that time. Soon after I was 6, my father began giving me Latin lessons, and I also went to school. I did not mind school. It was easy for me, since I was always ahead of the others and had learned to read before I went there. However, I remember a time when I could not read, but pestered my mother to read aloud to me out of the Orbis Pictus, an old, richly illustrated children's book, which contained an account of exotic religions, especially that of the Hindus. There were illustrations of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, which I found an inexhaustible source of interest. My mother later told me that I always returned to these pictures. Whenever I did so, I had an obscure feeling of their affinity with my original revelation, which I never spoke of to anyone. It was a secret I must never betray. Indirectly, my mother confirmed this feeling, for the faint tone of contempt with which she spoke of heathens did not escape me. I knew that she would reject my revelation with horror, and I did not want to expose myself to any such injury. This unchildlike behavior was connected, on the one hand, with an intense sensitivity and vulnerability, and on the other hand, and this especially, with the loneliness of my early youth. My sister was born 9 years after me, so I played alone and in my own way. Unfortunately, I cannot remember what I played. I recall only that I did not want to be disturbed. One of my reasons for liking school was that there I found at last the playmates I had lacked for so long. At school, I also discovered something else. But before I go into this, I should first mention that the nocturnal atmosphere had begun to thicken. All sorts of things were happening at night, things incomprehensible and alarming. My parents were sleeping apart. I slept in my father's room. From the door to my mother's room came frightening influences. At night, mother was strange and mysterious. One night, I saw coming from her door a faintly luminous, indefinite figure whose head detached itself from the neck and floated along in front of it, in the air, like a little moon. Immediately, another head was produced and again detached itself. This process was repeated 6 or 7 times. I had anxiety dreams of things that were now small, now large. For instance, I saw a tiny ball at a great distance. Gradually it approached, growing steadily into a monstrous and suffocating object. Or I saw telegraph wires with birds sitting on them, and the wires grew thicker, and my fear greater, until the terror woke me. Although these dreams were overtures to the physiological changes of puberty, they had in their turn a prelude which occurred about my 7th year. At that time I was sick with pseudo-croup, accompanied by choking fits. One night, during an attack, I stood at the foot of the bed, my head bent back over the bed rail, while my father held me under the arms. Above me, I saw a glowing blue circle about the size of the full moon, and inside it moved golden figures, which I thought were angels. This vision was repeated, and each time it allayed my fears of suffocation. But the suffocation returned in the anxiety dreams. I see in this a psychogenic factor. The atmosphere of the house was beginning to be unbreathable. I had in those days a yellow varnished pencil case of the kind commonly used by primary school pupils, with a little lock and the customary ruler. At the end of this ruler, I now carved a little mannequin, about 2 inches long, with frock coat, top hat, and shiny black boots. I colored him black with ink, sawed him off the ruler, and put him in the pencil case, where I made him a little bed. I even made a coat for him out of a bit of wool. In the case, I also placed a smooth, oblong, blackish stone from the Rhine, which I had painted with watercolors to look as though it were divided into an upper and lower half, and had long carried around in my trouser pocket. This was his stone. All this was a great secret. I took the case to the attic at the top of the house and hid it with great satisfaction on one of the beams under the roof, for no one must ever see it. I knew that not a soul would ever find it there. No one could discover my secret and destroy it. I felt safe, and the tormenting sense of being at odds with myself was gone. In all difficult situations, whenever I had done something wrong or my feelings had been hurt, or when my father's irritability or my mother's invalidism oppressed me, I thought of my carefully bedded down and wrapped up mannequin and his smooth, prettily colored stone. From time to time, often at intervals of weeks, I secretly stole up to the attic when I could be certain that no one would see me. Then I clambered up on the beam, opened the case, and looked at my mannequin and his stone. Each time I did this, I placed in the case a little scroll of paper on which I had previously written something during school hours in a secret language of my own invention. The addition of a new scroll always had the character of a solemn ceremonial act. Unfortunately, I cannot remember what I wanted to communicate to the mannequin. I only know that my letters constituted a kind of library for him. I fancy, though I cannot be certain, that they may have consisted of sayings that particularly pleased me. The meanings of these actions, or how I might explain them, never worried me. I contented myself with the feeling of newly won security, and was satisfied to possess something that no one knew and no one could get at. It was an inviolable secret, which must never be betrayed, for the safety of my life depended on it. Why that was so, I did not ask myself. It was simply so. This possession of a secret had a very powerful formative influence on my character. I consider it the essential factor of my boyhood. Similarly, I never told anyone about the dream of the phallus. The little wooden figure with the stone was a first attempt, still unconscious and childish, to give shape to the secret. I was always absorbed by it and had the feeling I ought to fathom it, and yet I did not know what it was I was trying to express. I always hoped I might be able to find something, perhaps in nature, that would give me the clue and show me where or what the secret was. At that time my interest in plants, animals, and stones grew. I was constantly on the lookout for something mysterious. Consciously, I was religious in the Christian sense, though always with the reservation, "But it is not so certain as all that," or "What about that thing under the ground?" And when religious teachings were pumped into me and I was told, "This is beautiful and this is good," I would think to myself, "Yes, but there is something else, something very secret that people don't know about." The episode with the carved mannequin formed the climax and conclusion of my childhood. It lasted about a year. Thereafter, I completely forgot the whole affair until I was 35. Then, this fragment of memory rose up again from the mists of childhood with pristine clarity. While I was engaged on the preliminary studies for my book, Symbols and Transformation, I read about the cache of soul stones near Alzheim and the Australian Turingus. I suddenly discovered that I had a quite definite image of such a stone, though I had never seen any reproductions. It was oblong, blackish, and painted into an upper and lower half. This image was joined by that of the pencil box and the mannequin. The mannequin was a little cloaked god of the ancient world, a telesphorus, such as stands on the monument of Asclepios, and reads to him from a scroll. Along with this recollection, there came to me, for the first time, the conviction that there are archaic psychic components which have entered the individual psyche without any direct line of tradition. School years. One day in the early summer of 1887, when I was 12 years old, I was standing in the cathedral square, waiting for a classmate who went home by the same route as myself. It was 12 o'clock, and the morning classes were over. Suddenly, another boy gave me a shove that knocked me off my feet. I fell, striking my head against the curbstone so hard that I almost lost consciousness. At the moment I felt the blow, the thought flashed through my mind, "Now you won't have to go to school any more." I was only half unconscious, but I remained lying there a few moments longer than was strictly necessary, chiefly in order to avenge myself on my assailant. Then people picked me up and took me to a house nearby, where two elderly spinster aunts lived. From then on, I began to have fainting spells whenever I had to return to school, and whenever my parents set me to doing my homework. For more than 6 months, I stayed away from school, and for me, that was a picnic. I was free, could dream for hours, be anywhere I liked, in the woods or by the water, or draw. Above all, I was able to plunge into the world of the mysterious. To that realm belonged trees, a pool, a swamp, stones and animals, and my father's library. But I was growing more and more away from the world, and had all the while faint pangs of conscience. I frittered away my time with loafing, collecting, reading, and playing, but I did not feel any happier for it. I had the obscure feeling that I was fleeing from myself. I forgot completely how all this had come about, but I pitied my parents' worries. They consulted various doctors, who scratched their heads and packed me off to spend the holidays with relatives in Winterthur. This city had a railroad station that proved a source of endless delight to me. But when I returned home, everything was as before. One doctor thought I had epilepsy. I knew what epileptic fits were like, and I inwardly laughed at such nonsense. My parents became more worried than ever. Then one day, a friend called on my father. They were sitting in the garden, and I hid behind a shrub, for I was possessed of an insatiable curiosity. I heard the visitor saying to my father, "And how is your son?" "Ah, that's a sad business," my father replied. "The doctors no longer know what is wrong with him. They think it may be epilepsy. It would be dreadful if he were incurable. I have lost what little I had, and what will become of the boy if he cannot earn his own living?" I was thunderstruck. This was the collision with reality. "Why, then I must get to work," I thought suddenly. From that moment on, I became a serious child. I crept away, went to my father's study, took out my Latin grammar, and began to cram with intense concentration. After 10 minutes of this, I had the finest of fainting fits. I almost fell off the chair, but after a few minutes I felt better and went on working. "Devil take it, I'm not going to faint," I told myself, and persisted in my purpose. This time it took about 15 minutes before the second attack came. That, too, passed like the first. "And now you must really get to work," I told myself. I stuck it out, and after an hour came the third attack. Still I did not give up, and worked for another hour, until I had the feeling that I had overcome the attacks. Suddenly I felt better than I had in all the months before. And in fact the attacks did not recur. From that day on, I worked over my grammar and other schoolbooks every day. That was when I learned what a neurosis is. Gradually, the recollection of how it had all come about returned to me, and I saw clearly that I myself had arranged this whole disgraceful situation. I had a feeling of rage against myself, and at the same time, was ashamed of myself. For I knew that I had wronged myself and made a fool of myself in my own eyes. Nobody else was to blame. I was the cursed renegade. What led me astray during the crisis was my passion for being alone, my delight in solitude. Nature seemed to me full of wonders, and I wanted to steep myself in them. Every stone, every plant, every single thing seemed alive and indescribably marvelous. I immersed myself in nature, crawled, as it were, into the very essence of nature, and away from the whole human world. One fine summer day, I came out of school at noon and went to the cathedral square. The sky was gloriously blue, the day one of radiant sunshine. The roof of the cathedral glittered, the sun sparkling from the new brightly glazed tiles. I was overwhelmed by the beauty of the sight and thought, "The world is beautiful and the church is beautiful, and God made all this and sits above it far away in the blue sky on a golden throne and..." Here came a great hole in my thoughts and a choking sensation. I felt numbed and knew only, "Don't go on thinking now. Something terrible is coming, something I do not want to think, something I dare not even approach." Why not? Because I would be committing the most frightful of sins. What is the most terrible sin? Murder? No, it can't be that. The most terrible sin is the sin against the Holy Ghost, which cannot be forgiven. Anyone who commits that sin is damned to hell for all eternity. That would be very sad for my parents if their only son, to whom they are so attached, should be doomed to eternal damnation. I cannot do that to my parents. All I need do is not go on thinking. That was easier said than done. On my long walk home, I tried to think all sorts of other things, but I found my thoughts returning again and again to the beautiful cathedral which I loved so much, and to God sitting on the throne, and then my thoughts would fly off again as if they had received a powerful electric shock. I reached home in a pretty worked-up state. My mother noticed that something was wrong and asked, "What is the matter with you? Has something happened at school?" I did have the thought that it might help me to confess to my mother the real reason for my turmoil. But to do so, I would have to do the very thing that seemed impossible, think my thought right to the end. That night I slept badly. Again and again the forbidden thought, which I did not yet know, tried to break out, and I struggled desperately to fend it off. The next 2 days were sheer torture, and my mother was convinced that I was ill. But I resisted the temptation to confess, aided by the thought that it would cause my parents intense sorrow. On the third night, however, the torment became so unbearable that I no longer knew what to do. I awoke from a restless sleep, just in time to catch myself thinking again about the cathedral and God. I had almost continued the thought. Sweating with fear, I sat up in bed to shake off sleep. Now it is coming. Now it's serious. I must think. It must be thought out beforehand. Why should I think something I don't know and don't want to know? Where does this terrible will come from? And why should I be the one to be subjected to it? I haven't done this or wanted this. It has come on me like a bad dream. Where do such things come from? This has happened to me without my doing. Why? After all, I didn't create myself. I came into this world the way God made me, that is, the way I was shaped by my parents. Or can it have been that my parents wanted something of this sort? But my good parents would never have had any thoughts like that. Nothing so atrocious would ever have occurred to them.